So a lot of the most exciting things from information security actually come from a few years back when people used to do things more for fun, more so than to be malicious. One virus that I happened to come across at one point would take all of the pictures and files on your computer and replace them with a picture of a squid, believe it or not. That's all it did.
Well, that's bad if you have kid pictures and professional pictures that you need for presentations.
Of course. We always recommend people back things up, of course. So,
how should people do that in this day and age? Do they want a cloud service, or do they want multiple external hard drives that they unplug and back up every so often, or what?
So it really depends on the depth you want to go into. Here at ISU, we have a couple different redundant systems that we back up data to. But for a normal everyday user, sometimes something as simple as just using a flash drive or external hard drive to back up your data. Or you could look up a few other more advanced techniques, such as running your hard drives in RAID, and et cetera.
Kevin, the nation has largely been educated about computer viruses, about social engineering emails that will get you to download viruses. Should they really be worrying about that so much anymore? Are there other challenges for computer security?
Well, social engineering phishing scams or targeted phishing scams are still very, very much so with us today. But the drive-by malvertising is a good example of one where you get malware from a link you've clicked on a website. I was just actually before coming over here reading a report about new malware that sits in your random access memory so that when you log off your computer, it disappears. But it has infected your computer and taken stuff while it's there, but yet there's no trace of it left. And then ransomware, of course, is really, really taking a bite out of people's protection these days because it encrypts their files. In fact, the FBI is still recommending that people pay the ransom, which is not something normal for the federal government to recommend.
Law enforcement says, give in. Go ahead. Pay the blackmailer.
Unless you've backed up and can just say, I don't need to worry about it.
The old story goes with Rudyard Kipling, once you pay the Dane Geld, you'll never get rid of the Dane. I mean, what's the guarantee that they'll go ahead and unencrypt you?
And that is the interesting part to it. They are finding, and it's kind of entertaining to laugh at the concept of honor among thieves, but they generally do send the keys. I actually suggest people keep their stuff backed up. A thumb drive is a great way of doing that. A cloud service is not a bad way of doing that. Here at ISU, students have access to Office 365 and OneDrive. Keeping their data in that is a great thing because I don't think that paying once is a great idea because they could come back at you again.
How much does it usually cost?
It depends on who you are and where you are a lot of times and what they get. But generally, I would say most ordinary people's are somewhere between $50 and $350. There was recently a university in Canada that was hit by a ransomware attack, and they paid $20,000.
If you're backing up using a cloud service and you get hit with ransomware, how do you guarantee that your cloud service isn't also nicked?
You cannot necessarily guarantee that it won't affect your cloud service. It all depends on how you have that set up. So if you were backing up to a cloud service as opposed to an online automatic connection, if it's an online automatic connection, any connected drive could get encrypted in the ransomware. But if it's one where you are connecting to it just to back up your documents, where OneDrive saves us here is that that's routinely backed up over a period of time. So we'd have to go back several days to a backup to get to it.
There are different versions of it out there.
Yes. You might lose a little bit, but not all of it.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The topic is computer security, and our guests today are Kevin Kraus, ISU's Director of Information Security, and ISU graduate student and info security worker Seth Pheasant. Seth, what are the top things that you see on a day-to-day basis coming across your desk?
Every single day, you'll see a barrage of your phishing and spear phishing attacks. That's pretty much routine. Other than that, we actually work with a lot of departments on campus just to be a part of any new programs or any new software that are trying to bring about to make sure that ISU is entering into contracts with safe companies who are going to protect our data and our users' data.
Although many may know by now after the DNC hack and the hack of Hillary Clinton's campaign manager, Distinguish for listeners the difference between spear phishing and phishing.
Regular phishing attacks are kind of like a fisherman going to sea and just casting a wide net. These aren't really targeted at anyone in particular, and it's just trying to catch someone in an opportunistic fashion. Whereas spear phishing is more targeted to an organization, a group within an organization, or even potentially a specific individual. These will have specific branding for the organization. Some that we see will actually have users' names as the signature, as well as other ISU logos and whatnot.
According to some estimates, 9 out of 10 computer users can't distinguish phishing from legitimate emails in the first place. Even if you train somebody, they get rocking and rolling on their email and triaging it, and they get moving fairly fast down the queue, delete, delete, delete. Oh, that looks interesting. Click. Oops. How do you get people to engage in good digital hygiene no matter what the pressures of the day bring?
Really, it is just user education. We can't force people to not click on a link. At ISU, we do blacklist tens of links a day so that they're not accessible on campus, but that doesn't really stop someone from going to their house and opening the link. You can only protect people from themselves so far.
Kevin, after the nation's intelligence community gave a public verdict that Russia did indeed try to hack the election, the response from the Republicans so far has been, well, there's no evidence that there was an actual effect on the election. How would we know?
Well, I think the difficult thing in cyber warfare, which is really what we're in a hot war with the Russians, we're in a hot war with the Chinese, we're in a hot war with the Iranians when it comes to a cyber war. We don't really know the actual effects of all of that, and I don't think we can tell all the effects of all that. I would say that the unclassified information that is distributed to the public isn't anywhere near as much information as they have. But I also think that the attribution is so difficult. We, as the general public, make assumptions based on what they're making assumptions on. So it's a tough one to figure out, but we have cyber warfare activity going on from our direction as well, too.
What do you know that the lay people do not about that particular situation with the campaign?
In reading that information, I can't necessarily say from what they released to us that I would have attributed directly to the Russian government as opposed to elements that are known to be associated with the Russian government. They may have more information than they have disclosed, and I'm sure they do, but the way that report read to me was, oh, they think this is what it is, but they aren't telling us for sure why they think that.
How should the nation go about protecting the solidity and continuity of its election process?
I have a joke that I always run around talking about how we should just take everything back to paper and not worry about it. But, of course, then I would be out of a job. So, it gets very, very difficult when you think about it. I think DHS providing, the Department of Homeland Security, providing backup support for testing of systems, but it's the infrastructure hardening is where we're really going to have to go to with trying to protect our election process better. I don't know that this sort of influence is any different from my perspective than a government intentionally taking out ads or putting money into political campaigns. I mean, there's so many different ways of influencing these things. I think we're at a crossroads in our country. We've got to figure it out. But I do know anything electronic is hackable.
Well, with the Internet of Things, how are we to safeguard our homes then if there are toasters and refrigerators and ovens and thermostats all hooked up?
Some basic ways in which people can try to protect themselves a little more are potentially not having those devices attached, making sure that they have a decent router at home with a good firewall, and that they, just like they do with their home computer virus protection, make sure that they're keeping it updated and patched. There's a lot more user as technician now because it's in your home so prevalently. My daughter recently got a Amazon Echo for Christmas. Or not Echo, Alexa. Is that it?
Echo Dot?
Yes, thank you. She was trying to change the channel on her television to something else because she was kind of singing along with it. And Alexa attempted to order
an album for her.
Oops.
And it's we're just going to have to be more cautious with what we do and realize that, I hate to say it, but privacy is kind of an illusion now.
You mentioned routers. My router is 5 years old. I haven't done a whole lot with it. What should I be doing with it, and when should I replace it?
I would replace it, and I'm sure that any one of us off air would be more than happy to give you a recommendation on what you should go with.
Okay.
But really, age of the equipment isn't necessarily the problem. It's a matter of whether it's still supported, and you're keeping its firmware updated, and you're keeping software updated around your equipment at home. That's more of the issue. But a five-year-old router, you would probably want to replace no matter what, because the speeds are so much greater now and you would have much better coverage, particularly as you add IoT devices. It's going to slow you down more and more and more.
A lot of the software out there today for commercial websites that you referenced earlier is not just on a website. It's on an app. Even the Windows 10 environment, they're calling them apps as opposed to sites anymore. Does that present a specific challenge?
I think the semantics around it can somewhat make people think something's safer than it is. I think all the in-app purchases and abilities within the apps to communicate always put you at more of a risk of information compromise or clicking on something. I think the terminology change is keeping up with the changes in society and digital natives. They use cell phones and apps and iPads or Google tablets and apps. They don't use the web like we did. And I kind of oftentimes joke with Seth about the fact that he's a digital native and I'm a digital dinosaur. That was only in the 90s. I mean, it doesn't seem that long ago to me.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking about computer security today with Kevin Krause and Seth Pheasant of ISU. You mentioned cell phones. Cell phones present a whole other opportunity to become infected or lose your identity or to get malware and propagate it elsewhere.
Well, there are a number of ways that could happen. This is really nothing more than an internet-connected telephone or an internet-connected storage device or computer. It's all really just like your laptop, except a different operating system. I recently saw a report. They were saying something along the lines of 75% of all paid apps have been compromised at some point in time or another. So when you've downloaded with your phone, you've probably added a virus to your phone or could have. The virus protection softwares that are out there today are great at catching static things, but they're signature-based. So that means that you've had to have uploaded a signature, it's had to have been found, and the way to treat it has had to have been out there. Otherwise, you're just running along with it. As the payment capabilities go along with your phones, where you can, the automatic payment from your telephone by beaming it, that stuff makes these devices directly linked to your bank accounts. All the information that you want to get off of somebody, pictures, passwords, everything is being carried around in this little tiny compartment that can be easily stolen both digitally or physically.
The old advice used to be, use your credit card online, use your debit card in person. Does that hold anymore, or is it largely an illusion?
I think it's largely an illusion. I prefer to use a credit card over a debit card almost any time, because at least it's not directly linked to your account. And point-of-sale machines at any place you go to buy a pizza or gas or anything are just as vulnerable, because they're also connected online as anything you'd buy from a website.